In a world haunted by tourists and crippled by mass transit delays, where the outlook is bleak and creativity has been sapped, two artists will unite their passion and dare to strip away the bullshit and talk about movies. Movies in the Buff.
Can I ask you a question?
There's nothing to talk about.
What were you planning on doing if you actually got the plane and the pilots, huh?
Excuse me?
You don't want a plane. You never did. Whoever heard of bank robbers escaping on a plane with 50 hostages? You saw Dog Day Afternoon. You're stalling. Why? I don't know. What's the matter? You can't get into the safe?
Perhaps.
There's two ways out of this. The easy way, we walk out the front door together, or the hard boys cut the power, hit you with the tear gas, and come in strong through the glass is your choice. You don't want that. I don't want that. And you know they'd like to do it tonight. You got night vision? You got gas masks?
Maybe.
I'm this close to ordering it.
Let's cut the crap. First, you don't order an assault when no hostages have been killed and there's no immediate threat. Second, if it ends that way, whatever happens, you don't get to be the hero. You want to bullshit me, try harder. Let's go.
Okay. I tell you what, my ass is covered, sport, but I would not get too comfortable in here if I were you.
No, I got the cable guy coming on Wednesday.
Why don't you just walk out the door?
I will. I'm gonna walk out of that door when I'm good and ready.
Can I get you to do that today? I didn't think so.
Any other proposals?
Oh, please, do not say proposals. My girlfriend, she wants a proposal from me.
You think you're too young to get married?
No, I'm not too young. I'm too broke. Maybe I should rob a bank.
You love each other?
Yeah, we do.
The money shouldn't really matter.
Thank you, bank robber.
I'm just saying, money can't buy love.
Thank you. Very much. I'm learning so much today, you know? Look, why don't we go across the street to the Kalani Rose, huh? Forget about this dangerous hostage situation. I'll buy you a beer, my treat.
Thanks, Detective, but I'm trying to stay away from bars, if you know what I mean.
Well, if you change your mind, there's still a standing offer, all right? Sounds long for the graveyard. Prison white or toe tag. Make up your mind. Tick-tock, tick-tock.
Hey! Hey! We done?
You just crossed the fucking line. Buses, Kojak, parked outside. You think I'm bluffing? You roll the dice and see what happens.
Aight, you ride?
At dawn.
At dawn. Welcome, everybody, to this week's episode of Movies in the Buff, where we will talk about Mulholland Drive.
Incorrect.
Oh, all right. We are doing a Clockwork Orange. Yeah. No, we're doing Inside Man, a first Spike Lee movie on the podcast. Yeah. Pretty fun. Not to be confused with Spike Jones, which we have done on this podcast.
Correct.
They're two very different people.
Very different people, very different artists. Both have great stuff, but yes. Yeah, very different.
Opposite sides of the spectrum here. Yeah. Exciting.
Spike Lee's stuff is generally devoid of the ennui of Spike Jonze's stuff. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, totally. And you have never seen this movie before you watched it for this episode, correct?
That is correct. It was one of those that I've probably lied about seeing in the past. We're like, oh yeah, Inside Man. I probably heard or saw a trailer and was like, I get it.
yeah, right.
But no, watching this through, I can absolutely confirm that I've never seen this.
Cool. Great. That's always fun. I like when that ends up happening on
me too.
On here. I am drinking, still sticking with what I was on last episode with Mulholland Drive, with Ella Jones, Colorado Straight Bourbon Whiskey. I'm not going to go back and read the Family Jones story, but
Integrity Farms.
It's very Mother Nature's talent for processed soil, seed, water, and wood. Like, okay, guys. It's awesome. So that's what I'm drinking.
Ella Jones. I love that you love your product, but also just tone it down a little bit.
Have some integrity with your product, Ella.
Have some fucking respect.
it is good, though. A Colorado straight bourbon whiskey from the Family Jones Distillery. So if you see it anywhere, I would recommend it. Brett?
Great. Yeah, I'm drinking a what is a new to me whiskey, or well, not new to me because I've had it on this podcast, but new as of this podcast, called King's Creek, Smoky Mountain King's Creek, Tennessee Sour Mash Whiskey. It is a 9-year whiskey made in the Tennessee tradition, using charcoal filters and things like that.
Integrity.
It is an integrity. It's delicious. I find it a nice, smooth taste. This was one that was recommended to me by an employee at the liquor store. And normally that's like they recommend it because they have high margins on those products and things like that. Mm-hmm. But this is actually a really, really good one.
Nice.
What's
it called again?
It's called King's Creek. Yeah, that's what I'm drinking.
Nice, man. Well, cheers, dude.
Cheers.
Cool. Well, I don't know. This might be the first of on here, but it was kind of cool to be like, you can find this movie streaming on Peacock as of the time of this recording.
Yeah.
And I kind of, this was one where they had like a, I don't know if it was the same for you, but it was like, watch all these ads at the beginning so then you can enjoy your movie ad free.
Oh, nice.
Like I dig that a lot.
Yeah. Sure, if that's what it gets me to, you know, get a movie like this, you know, if I have to watch 4 or 5 minutes of ads at the beginning, whatever.
Yeah, totally. So it's like I turned it on and
watch them.
Exactly, I turned it on and then I like got the popcorn or get the drinks or go to the bathroom and then I come out. I'm like, okay, now I'm ready to go. It was like,
awesome. Or more realistically, turn it on and then like I'm still fucking around on my phone.
Yeah, right.
Not doing any of those. Any of those things. No, I actually surprisingly own this movie.
Oh, nice.
I think I don't remember buying it.
Maybe you have my copy because I was like, I for sure own this movie, and then I don't.
This is a digital copy, exclusively. I think what happened was like Apple had one of those like $5 movie sales on iTunes, and I probably had a whiskey or two and was like, boop, boop.
Dude, I love that. I love, because that happens to me sometimes where I'm like, I'll go to like buy a movie or be like, oh, you know, I should have this in my collection. And then I like go and like, oh, I do have this in my collection. or yeah, you own something that you've never seen and you're like, why do I own this if I've never seen this? How do I have?
Right.
Anyway, yeah, that's awesome. Well, the synopsis on Peacock is as follows. A police detective, a bank robber, and a broker enter high-stakes negotiations after a brilliant heist spirals into a tense hostage situation. 86% Rotten Tomatoes, 85% audience score, 2006 thriller, 2 hours, 8 minutes.
Nice. Sure.
Rated fine. R.
Rated R.
yeah, it was... I think that's pretty good. That's, you know, pretty heisty, and that's kind of what it is. Three different storylines that we follow, and that's the movie. The end.
Yeah, and the Thanks. Flashback segments, and the guy with the dumpster, and the diner scenes, all of it.
Yeah,
you know,
yep.
Just working on a lot of levels. So
yeah, definitely. So who's your Judi Dench? No, serious question. Reaction. Overall reaction. Did you enjoy your watching of it? Were you know, like how, since you'd never seen it before?
Well, I fucking hated it.
Yeah, that checks out.
No, of course I didn't hate it. I love heist movies. They're my guilty pleasure movies. I really respond to the general tension in them. I think it, you know, a lot of the, like, you know, when we did classic action movie line type things, like there are a lot of heist movie lines and tropes and things like that that I really like.
Yeah.
I was really impressed by, I had a really great time watching this. I thought it was a really, really fun watch and a nice kind of palate cleanser from the two kind of headier movies we already talked about this season.
Big time.
I have some things that bugged me a little bit. Some choices, one particular actor. But that's every movie, right?
Yeah, sure.
Because I am impossible to please.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Unless you're Paul Thomas Anderson, in which case just inject it into my veins.
I was going to say, like, in which case, please me. Like,
please, Paul Thomas Anderson and Maya Rudolph, will you adopt me?
Yeah, right. Yeah. I saw this in theaters when it came out and enjoyed it. Have enjoyed it ever since. It's always been one of my kind of like fun go-to movies, but it was really cool watching it now because it'd been a few years since I'd seen it, especially with the context of Dog Day Afternoon, because they reference this so much, and I didn't realize how many that there were several crossovers
as soon as he asked for the fucking plane. I was like, Dog Day Afternoon.
Yeah.
Dog Day Afternoon.
And then they legit just call it out. He's like, yeah. This is Dog Day Afternoon. You've seen how this ends. Like, doesn't end well or whatever. Like,
right.
Like, that's so cool.
We find out that JFK.
Yeah. And the woman who plays Miriam Douglas, who was the older woman who refuses to strip when Clive Owen asked, is a hostage in the movie Dog Day Afternoon.
Oh, is she?
And plays the character named Miriam in a bank heist hostage movie in Dog Day Afternoon.
Whoa.
Oh, shoot.
Galaxy brain time.
Yes. And then I think there's also, I found this in the cast list afterward, that Lionel Pina, who also appeared in Dog Day Afternoon as a pizza delivery man, appears in Inside Man as a policeman who delivers pizzas at the bank's front door, too. So, again, I had a lot more context for classic heist movies and coming from and getting the references that Spike Lee has clearly placed in this.
Right. But
overall, that's my general kind of fun.
How does it feel being referencing a movie you hate?
It was interesting, honestly, because Dog Day was not my favorite movie. And so it was interesting looking at a heist movie that I saw when I was like, I was watching Inside Man while Brett was watching Dog Day Afternoon, probably. And so like, I'm looking at something on like a much more removed level of artistic, maybe, I don't know, like lower art maybe than Dog Day was or whatever. So it was fucking interesting. Now,
filthy populist. Kidding.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable, Brett. I'm going to let that one slide this time, but I'll probably let it slide next time, too. I love kind of just tracking the last few episodes. Just, I don't know why I'm on this kick of just like entering into movies and how movies start. But
that's the tone, man.
Yeah, I have always loved this like Bollywood song that comes in. And I remember that blew my fucking mind when I first saw this in 2006, because I had never been exposed to that kind of music or that style of music, really.
Sure.
And so then when it was like remixed with, you know, an American rap artist, and I don't know who it is, but I'm gonna take that note down. I was just like, holy shit, that is so cool. From bin to bin, way deep in the dish, I'll back to see you in the video of a New York track, queen of the screen. 35 mil, she's gotta be OP in LA, and he's king of the hill. Bollywood love story, straight out of the film. I've seen it before, but we can handle it for real. The earth shook when we came together, when she put the biggest diamond on my Punjabi track. That was the moment she brought the world together. Right now, all I gotta do is show my love back. Such an interesting way in to this movie that the song plays over the like producer cards and everything, and this has nothing to do with Bollywood. There's not like,
no, you know, do you know how it got chosen?
No, that's why I'm,
you
I'm
know why?
Curious. No, tell me. Yes, tell me.
So this is, it's a song that's composed by A.R. Rahman, who did the composition for Slumdog Millionaire.
Okay.
And it's actually from a Bollywood movie from the late 90s. I forget the name of it.
Okay.
And when Spike Lee was teaching film school, presumably at NYU. He does that. He just kind of like walks into NYU. He's like, hey, I want to teach a class. And they're like, please, Spike Lee.
Yes. yeah, right.
I also just quick sidebar, like Spike Lee is a director I admire, but I am not very familiar with his work almost at all. Mm-hmm. So I can't really speak to his, you know, the breadth and his stylistic choices all the time. But the apocryphal story about this goes that he was teaching this class and a film student's like, hey, have you seen this Bollywood movie, yada, 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 from 1998? He's like, no, he watched it, loved the song. He's like, I'm putting that song in a movie.
Wow.
And then he got hired to do this joint, as he calls them. Yep. And was like, I don't fucking care. This is a cool fucking song. I'm putting it over the credits. Doesn't have anything to do with the movie at all.
No, it doesn't. And that's what's so interesting talking about like entrances into movies, you know, like the last two were very specific with their, you know, first music we hear and first whatever. And this is like, we're just kind of cruising through the streets of New York, looking at all these like, oh, maybe it's even, no, it's after that. Like the, is it? So do we get the song and then do we get Clive Owen's intro and then do we get the like tour through New York in the van, or do we get the tour through the van and then Clive Owen?
I have no fucking, no, it's Clive Owen's the first thing.
Yeah. And then after that.
It's a direct address to the audience.
Yeah, right. So it's so cool that we get like.
Because he goes, as the bard would say, there's the rub. And then we get into the van and we start the opening of the heist.
Yeah, yeah. So that's so cool too. I mean, this is peak Clive Owen. I mean, Children of Men, Sin City, like.
Yeah, he did Closer.
The Interpreter, Closer,
Closer, Children of Men, and this movie, and Casino Royale. No, not.
Born,
thank you. I was like, that's the wrong movie in the field. and Born, all within like a 4-year stretch.
Yeah, right.
And he was theoretically lined up to be the next Bond, and that didn't happen. And then he kind of fell off the face of the planet.
Yeah, yeah. He kind of started doing smaller, different, like kind of, like he did Shoot 'Em Up in like 2008. Like he's done smaller action, kind of making fun of himself in some ways. Do you know what his current project is? What he's doing exactly in this exact moment?
I don't.
He is playing President Bill Clinton in Impeachment, the Monica Lewinsky story, through the, it's called American Crime Classics or whatever, but it's on FX with Sarah Paulson. They did O.J. Simpson in the first go round. They did
the Ryan
Versace.
Murphy stuff.
Yeah. And so now he's playing Bill Clinton, in that. And it's a really interesting casting choice because that kind of like, suave swagger that Clive Owen has is kind of understated, and Clive already kind of like speaks a little bit off his voice a little bit, so that when you start adding in a little bit
it makes sense. He's got the schnoz for it.
Well, but they put on a huge prosthetic schnoz on it. It is bad. It's like guys, yeah. I love how when we open here, you know, just like, you know, talking about the entrance into the movie, just that direct address being like, pay very close attention. I already told you my name. That's the Who. Like, and you're like, oh shit, I wasn't ready. Wait, what was his name again? Did I miss something else? You know, it like gets you excited of like, you know.
Absolutely. It's a great fucking opening speech because you're like, it relieves you of all of the questions. If you just follow what he's saying, you're like, great, I know what's fucking happening, and now he's just going to show me how it happened.
Yeah, right. Yeah, like I love the line, there's a difference between being in prison and being in a cell. And you're like, okay, cool, yes. You know. And it also tells you, like, I'm going to be, if you pay close attention when we're telling it, quote, in real time, you're going to figure it out. You know, how many times in this damn movie do they say, how are you going to get out of this? He says, I'm going to walk out the front door. He says that like 8 times in this fucking movie. And you're like, you paying attention? That's what he's going to do. You know, asking for gum. You paying attention? You know, all these little things, which is fun. Yeah. And then the next thing I wanted to say was just the kind of cool tour through New York with all of the very specific building elements and architecture elements that Spike Lee chooses to like zoom in on, you know, like the gargoyles on the buildings, the saints, the stone work, with this Bollywood song playing over the background. And it is kind of cool. You know, it's just sort of like gets you into this like New York mode, you know?
Oh yeah, like, absolutely. It absolutely sets the scene.
Yeah.
You know, it's also, he desaturates the filter on New York as well. So it's a lot of really gray, you know, grays and blue, like blue gray type coloring, except for all of the brass and bronze that we see in the architectural building. And obviously, you know, New York being built when it was and when it, you know, really came of age as a city, all of that architecture and makes sense. But yeah, it's entirely endemic to the financial district. Like, you know, you know where the fuck you are, right? Or like you're down on Wall Street. So
yeah,
you're in FIDI. It's actually not FIDI, but
no, financial district.
Yeah.
That's another thing that I, you know, it's so interesting watching this movie after having lived in New York for a decade, because there is so much more that I picked up from this that I'm like, oh wow, this really is a love letter to New York in some ways. You know, I never really picked up how much they, like, clearly I knew that they focused on these individuals, but I think in general, and I'll call a couple of these out as we keep going through, but I was really struck by how much time and focus Spike Lee gives to the people of New York. You know, and the different types of people, the construction workers, the people talking loud on their phones with the, oh my God, you know, that kind of classic New York thing, the, you know, the security guards and the cops and the whole conversations about locations in New York. And
well, and I mean, there's a full fucking 5-minute conversation as to what Grand Central Terminal is called and whether or not subways run through it and who the fuck cares. And they're all complaining about trains and subways and whether or not Metro North actually like, it's just like, yes, I mean, that shit happens.
Yes, 100%, 100%. And I never picked up any of that before this watch through. I don't think I've watched this while I lived in New York. I think it was pre that last time I saw this. So I just think that was such a cool, you know, and he does it here too with just these, like, when you're driving down the street in New York, you look up at any fucking building and you're like, oh my God, how is this not in a museum here? This is, you know, the apartment buildings we lived in. And, you know, you're like, wow, this building was built in the 40s. I mean, this building.
Right. Or the fucking 20s.
Right. And the facade is gorgeous of these buildings. Yeah. Now the inside, you know, different, but, you know, so I think that's a really cool thing that I just didn't pick up on.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. I, you know, and then comes the best part of every heist movie, the setup, right? We skip the getting the gang together portion. The gang's already together, which is a little bit of a bummer.
Sure.
But you know, whatever, can't have everything, right?
Yeah.
but this setup and the plan and getting into their paint clothes and unloading the van and then walking into the bank and putting the lights down, I'm just like, let's do this. I knew this was coming. Like, let's rob this fucking bank, y'all. And it's always the way that Spike Lee does it, that other directors do it, and they just, you know, they give you a great aerial view of the area. They let you understand who is there, what type of people you might interact with later on in the movie. They give you a basic, you know, geography of how this bank is laid out. We know that it's, you know, there's only essentially one way in, one way out type of thing. You know, we understand how the teller counter is set up. We understand that there is a kiosk in the middle where you're filling out your deposit slips. When was the last time you had to fill out a deposit slip? Holy shit. I haven't filled out a deposit slip in 15 years.
I know, it's been a
while. I haven't been inside a bank in 5.
Yeah, right, right.
but yeah, I just, I, you know, It's classic stuff, man. It's what makes this genre of movie so titillating for me, right? To just jump right into this action. We see similar, you know, thinking forward a few years from this to The Town, right? Like a kind of similar action sequence happens in that. You know, and we see it all over. So it's just well done. It's well executed. And the, you know, the initial robbery is great. It's it's great. It's really suspenseful. It's really exciting when one of the Steve characters jumps up on the teller counter and is aiming the rifle over the top of the teller counter. I don't know that I've ever really seen that before.
Right.
Which is cool. Like, you know, sometimes somebody will jump over a counter or whatever, or break down a door or go through the fucking window. But I don't know that I've ever seen anybody like use that kind of elevation. Which is really cool. So,
and Spike Lee shoots it from below too. So it really does look like, wow, this guy is like, you know,
yeah, he's 20 feet in the fucking air is what it feels like.
Yeah. I think my favorite part about this whole opening scene, like the actual like start of the robbery, is the fact that they all come in and it's still business as normal. And for like the longest time, no one even notices that they're doing anything.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Generally, like in these type of movies, the people walk in and there's either like huge music happening or someone instantly is like, something's not right here, you know. And here it's like the music is really quiet or not even there. And they're just kind of standing there doing their thing, set up to this, set up to that. And then all of a sudden, now we're ready to fucking kick it off. So I think that's a cool.
Yeah, right. To this. Yeah, there's no Amanda Plummer moment.
Yeah, exactly.
From Pulp Fiction, right? Like, there's no. If I know you, motherfucker. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, then we meet. They tell everybody to get down, but.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and don't fucking move it on. They get a little bit of that, but. Yeah, as I say, and then we meet Denzel for the first time.
Yeah, I have a real appreciation for what Denzel does in this movie. It's you know, I have never been his biggest fan, but he does a lot of things really well.
Yeah.
And there's no denying it. And being a fucking smooth talker is one of them, right? Like he is an all time suave motherfucker,
dude.
No matter what, you know, what position, what his role is, that's just, that is right. That's why he's a Hollywood A-lister is the way he, that swagger, that, suavity. That's definitely not a word.
I'll take it because it's true. I mean, because we come in on him and he's not even like, he's doing his like Denzel under his breath voice thing, like, oh, hey, come on, what are you gonna do that thing for? I don't know, you know, that kind of thing. And he's on the phone and I just love that classic quality of Denzel, that sort of like under the breath, but I'm still kind of like, you know.
Yeah, you know, we see a lot of it too at the interrogation table too, where that kind of, and he and Chiwetel Ejiofor have great rapport in this movie too.
Yeah, they do.
They play off of each other really well, especially in those interrogation scenes.
Yeah.
Where they're, you know, trying to figure shit out and, you know, that, oh yeah, you're free to go. You're not free to go. You're free to go. You're not, I'm just kidding. You're free to go. You're not, like that kind of like.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all so fucking well executed.
It really is. It really is. I just got to call out the line he says to his wife. Big Willie and the twins when I get home. Get ready for Big Willie and the twins.
I know, when I get man. There is so much. Like, I haven't had my Johnson pulled like that.
Yeah. Yep. I have that one written down too. Yeah.
The last time I had my Johnson pulled like that, it cost me $5. $5?
He was in Tijuana. Don't ask. Yeah, I think the script in this is so good because it's not like a, you know, an Oscar award winning script kind of thing, but it's just the exact perfect of what it needs to be. It is quirky and quippy. It is silly, you know, quips and quirps.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
definitely not quirks, but quirps.
Yeah. Quirps. That's what I said.
Yeah.
I didn't say quirks.
Right.
It has the silly lines to it and also has some really good legit dialogue, you know? Pacing and back and forth. I think speaking just on Denzel as well, like his whole costume and character design is so well done. Like when he puts on that fucking 1940s hat,
the hat he has is like what makes it
the small mustache that, you know, the thin mustache and like a Duke Ellington type mustache. And he, his suit fits like an older time suit would fit, like a zoot suit type fit. And, you know, a lot of the music that then encompasses or goes around with his character is like jazzy trombone and trumpet and saxophone type themes. So like, you know, jumping all the way to the very end when he comes back and finally comes back to his wife to release Big Willie and the twins, there's like the lighting and the music. It feels like you're watching a jazz film noir detective thing. You know, and I think there's a cool, a jazzy, gotcha.
Yeah. Absolutely.
1940s detective.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, they make references to like Kojak and things like that in the movie. And it's the other, you know, heist movie or bank robbery movie trope of the cop that doesn't play by the rules, which Denzel has. That is his character. He is the pilot that doesn't play by the rules. He's the gangster that doesn't play by the rules. He's the
lawyer.
The lawyer that doesn't play by the rules.
Yeah. Absolutely, it dude.
Could go on, but could get in some dangerous territory there.
Yeah. yes.
I am not Denzel's biggest fan. There are a lot of movies of his that I do really like. I love Training Day.
Yeah.
But this is, you know, quickly assumed one of my favorite performances of his.
Great.
I think he's really, really good in this movie.
Yeah, I agree. I agree completely. I think he does really well.
Another heist movie trope that I really particularly like, and I think this movie does incredibly well, is having terrible background actors.
Dude, yeah. Really bad.
The background cops in this movie in particular are wild.
They're like South Park characters. Like they're like the oh yes, I'm gonna go there. Just like looking right at the camera and
well, and just like the posturing of like, I'm a cop. I'm playing a cop in a Denzel movie with Spike Lee. I'm a cop.
Yep.
And then I'm a fat cop. I'm going to hold my belly because I'm a fat cop.
yeah, totally.
Oh, man. And like
the ADR doesn't help either because the ADR in this movie is really bad.
Yeah, there's some really bad moments.
You can very much tell that Spike Lee, like even when the fucking cop comes up to like see smoke coming out the front doors of the bank, you can tell that there's he walks past a couple that's background actors, and you can tell that there's ADR that's like, oh, there's smoke coming out of there.
I do.
And then the
oh
couple,
my gosh.
Oh, yeah, it really is like, oh my gosh, there's smoke. Oh, okay, well, keep on walking. You know, like that is so bad.
I guess we should get out of here.
Yeah, right. And like that happens so much when like the cops or the SWAT team or whatever are piling out of the van, and it's like, you go there. Oh, I got this. Oh, he's gonna go there. And you're like all the big crowd scenes, like, oh, did you see that the news van's here? Like all of these horrible ADR lines. You're just like, what are you doing?
It's really bad. And to the background actors' credit, though, I've done FBI background work. It's when Kevin Bacon yelled at me.
Yeah.
It's not easy.
No.
Because you're not a lot there, you know, there are a lot of background actors that just do it for the experience or for fun or for whatever. There are a lot of actors that do it because they think they're really good actors and they think this is going to be their big break. And then there are other people that
discovered.
Yeah. And then there are other people that do it that actually are really good actors and either just want to be on a film set and experience a film set or need a day's pay or whatever. Mm-hmm. And being on set, especially in these large crowd scenes, the way it normally goes is like, you're lucky if an assistant director talks to you. Normally it's like a production assistant that's like, all right, everybody, we just need you to, you know, have a conversation. And you're like, okay, but I can't actually have the conversation because the scene is happening like 3 feet there and you don't actually want me to speak. So you literally want me to mime. Okay, that's tough, but here we go.
Yeah.
Right. And like with the cop stuff too, I mean, there was like 40 of us in this particular scene. And she's like, just look busy, everybody. Just look busy. Action.
Great. Yeah, right. Okay, I'll just keep dusting this thing, I guess.
Yeah, I guess I'll walk from here to there. Like you told me vaguely that you want me to start here and cross from camera left. Okay.
I guess I'll figure it out
and you'll tell me if it's wrong.
Yeah, right. Like maybe I can try honking at Kevin Bacon.
Exactly. Someone will tell me. Yeah, somebody will tell me that's wrong. Not a good idea. Maybe Kevin Bacon.
Maybe he himself might say that. Yeah. No, it's so true. And like in some of these that have like, you know, club scenes or whatever, music's not playing. And so all these people are like dancing to absolute silence.
And if it is, it's like somebody with a production assistant with like an iPhone.
Yeah, right. Right. Yeah, totally. And I think it's also good. I mean, I feel like there probably are a good number of these cops, background actor cops, that might actually be cops.
And there are, yes, 100%. There are also professional background actor cops.
Yes.
Because a lot of times when you get called in for background actor cop things, you have to have your own uniform.
Right.
Which requires you to buy it. So like if you pay really close attention, especially in New York television shows, it's like the same 70 cops. They're all actors and they just circulate through the television show.
Yeah, right, right. And the only reason I bring that up is like, well, you know, to kind of give credit that people are trying and, you know, they just like, oh, do this.
Absolutely.
It does definitely, I agree with you, show up. Just a word of the wise, anyone out there who ever does background, take it for what it is and enjoy the experience of being on set. And
yeah, enjoy craft services, take your $150 or whatever it is and
get the hustle and bustle.
Pay attention to how the fucking show is being shot, who's important, who's, you know, how the production runs, but it's not your moment.
Right.
Right. It's not. Nope. And you're not going to get discovered because for every one person that does, there are literally tens and tens of thousands of people that don't or make their reputation somehow worse.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Back to this movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Next thing I wanted to talk about was I love the camera work we're now down there, down in like the basement or whatever, in front of the vault. And Clive and the Steves are going around taking the cell phones from everybody.
Yes.
Putting them in the bag.
Yes.
There's just like really great camera work that's done that's just circling everything. It's always circular. It's like we're going to go down this, you know, the right side of the room, land on the vault, catch Clive in the middle and follow him back and then circle around and go to the other side and then do another circular shot to just establish the room again. And you know, contrasting it to this opening where a lot of it is quick cuts, just smash cut here, cut here, da, 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 to kind of like spend some time with these characters and see like, this is a small room. We are in a small space and this guy has the power, you know, and then we finally land on our guy who, I have him somewhere in here. Ray, nope, that's the father, Peter Hammond, who tries to outsmart Clive. You know, I guess I should use his real name.
Daryl. Dalton.
Yeah, one of them.
Dalton Russell. Daryl.
Daryl. Daryl also. And then we like, he then like searches through that, like as soon as, you know, Peter Hammond is like, he holds the gun to his head. No, I left it at home. And Clive goes, all right, I gave you your choice. I gave you your chance. And goes into the bag without saying a word and just starts opening cell phones and tossing them. And I just love the whole setup of the scene. I love that he doesn't like telegraph to us like, well, then I'm going to go check all these cell phones and try and find your number in it. And then if it rings, I'm going to kill you. He just goes, all right. And then we're kind of left to figure it out. And then we hear it ring. I like seeing Clive go into that back room and see him through that glass or whatever it is. of him just head in his hands, like, God, I didn't want to fucking do this. And you see, like, you see him sigh, like, all right. And then you see the beatdown again through that same glass. And I just, right. like, that whole scene for me was fun and terrifying. And you're like, oh, shit, he's for real. And the camera
was just... Yeah, no, it really meshes well. It really tells a really good story, I think, too. And to expand on the camera work, too, what I particularly love about it is the sense that because the camera is so fluid and constantly moving and we're rotating around people and coming over people's shoulders and shit, like coming up and down that aisle, it gives us a sense too that the situation is fluid and that everything is this is a continuous action, that there is no time to stop and think and consider. We got to move. We're moving through this. Right. And so even though the camera is kind of languid in its actual motion and smooth, it continues to move through the entire process and there are not a lot of cuts. And so it kind of gives this sense, this immediacy to it, right? Yeah, of things happening in real time and being important and that there's real tension in the room. Because when you start cutting away to people's faces, all of a sudden that tension starts to dissipate. And you actually kind of feel that in this scene when there is a particular cut to one side of the hostages. I think it's after they get on undressed, where it kind of feels like that ball drops. Like we talk about keeping the ball in the air, right? Keeping the conversation going. And it, like, there was one cut in particular there where it just kind of felt like to me the tension deflated a little bit because of the choice to cut there. And, you know, they may not have wanted to, but it may have been a necessity or whatever.
Yeah.
For continuity or for what they were able to capture or shooting
sound
schedules,
or
whatever.
Anything. Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Probably all of that. So,
yeah.
I love that scene too. The other moment in camera work that I really like is our discovery of Chris Plummer's character in his office.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Arthur Case. You know, obviously we come into this huge mahogany imbued office that is absolutely preposterous. Mm-hmm. And you're like, this only exists in movies. And you're like, yeah, it's a fucking movie. but there's, so I love the way that the camera works with his assistant or whatever, but the moment that really works for me and the choice to keep the camera so still is really effective is that his assistant, that is the new word for executive assistant, is the existent.
Existent. Yep. I like the that. Existent. I like it. The existent.
His assistant tells him there is one of our branches is being robbed. He's like, oh my gosh. Oh no. Is anybody hurt? You're like, then he may or may not actually care.
Yeah.
And then she tells him which branch it is. And he just, Chris Plummer is such a precise actor. He doesn't, there, as soon as she said, he like makes the realization of which branch it is, he literally does not move a muscle.
Mm-hmm.
There's no blinking. There's no mouth twitching. There's no stroking of the mustache or running his hands through his hair. He just sits there, stands there.
Mm-hmm.
Breathes into that moment, receives that information, realizes that he can't actually show how much that bothers him. And then dismisses her essentially. Uh-huh. And it's all done in complete stillness and it's fucking masterful. It's such a good moment. And the willingness of Spike Lee to let that camera just sit on him in that moment is so nice for a movie that is so active. It's a heist movie. You want, like, quick cuts are essential. You want to keep that adrenaline flowing, right? But in that particular moment, to let that sit with him and to let that moment drop in, it's also just a testament to the actors in this movie to, you know, it's really easy to play above the surface of this text to just, oh, I'm a former Nazi-ish bank owner. I'm gonna, oh my God, what? is anybody hurt? Oh no. Like it's so easy in this genre to go melodramatic or hyper dramatic or whatever you want to call it. And I think by and large, the actors don't do that. They play against that type. Like we don't even get our typical like Denzel screaming scene in this movie. Not really, right? Like maybe when he tackles Daryl or whatever his fucking name is, Dalton.
Yeah.
That's the most animated Denzel we get in this.
Yeah. Or when he thinks that the hostage has been shot. And he goes up and he's like,
shoot me,
take me right now.
That's the most,
but that's the closest. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I don't particularly think this script is great, but I agree with you that it does serve its purpose, and is good for this genre. Yeah. But I think because of the who's who of the actors in this movie, they do some really good work with some pretty mediocre lines.
Yeah, totally agree. And while we're on that, I'm glad you brought that up because that really is a great moment to elucidate like what true Hollywood greats do, like what the true acting legends can do, where they're just like don't move and everything changes. And you're like, you didn't even do anything and you did everything.
Yeah, but somehow everything changed.
Yeah, I saw your whole world drop out and you didn't do anything.
Like, right.
How? And I think like our main five or six actors, Denzel, Clive, Jodie Foster, Christopher Plummer, Willem Dafoe, and Chiwetel Ejiofor, they all do great, great work. You know, I feel like the only one that I'm like, why is Willem Dafoe in this movie is sort of like, I think of our like top six billed stars, I think he probably does the least amount of extra stuff to help the script along. Because I feel like a lot of what he does could be done by anybody.
He's a plot facilitator.
Yeah. And it's like, and why is that Willem Dafoe? Like at this point, he's still Willem Dafoe. He's still a known actor. I think it's probably just something where he's like
a known actor is what you said. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I heard he's an unknown actor. I was like, he was in a Scorsese movie like 20 years prior to this. So maybe not.
Well, and he's A-list at this point because he's just coming off of Spider-Man.
Yeah,
where he played the Sam Raimi Spider-Mans. And so it is interesting that you're like, oh yeah, Willem Dafoe just wanted to work with Spike Lee. He's like, just give me a role. I want to work with you.
Yeah.
You know, and he has some good moments, but it's just like,
I think he has some really great moments. Yeah. For me, and it's unfortunate that I have to point out the one woman with lines in this show. For me, Jodie Foster is the character and the performance that kind of I go back and forth on. It doesn't really... didn't really jibe with my sensibilities.
Sure.
I feel like she leaned a little bit too much into my bite is worse than my bark type thing.
Yeah.
Not that particular line or that scene, but just that kind of smudgeness. her smugness and the perception of power that her character has. And like, she's a fixer, so yes, she has a ton of power, but for me it was a little one note through the course of the movie. I feel like she was kind of getting at the same thing in every scene, and I didn't feel like there was a lot of dynamism in the character. I don't know if that's her fault or the script's fault, but
I was gonna say it feels like that's a script fault when in a massively male heavy movie and the few women that are in it are objectified. And because I feel like there are the moments that we do get to see Jodie Foster do her thing, like when Christopher Plummer calls her a cunt and her reaction and the way she takes that moment, I think is really good work. And I think there are a couple of other lines or moments between lines that are really good for me for her. And exactly what you said, to call out the one woman, like, I don't think the script was very well written for women in general in this.
Yeah, not at all. Not at all.
So anyway, that's all of, however, another big thing I want to talk about, like I mentioned before, is all of these like tertiary hostage characters that I fucking fall in love with. You know, the next note that I have is the old guy who's like having a heart attack or whatever, who gets sent out of the bank.
Yes.
And I just, it's one of the, it's like a New York City snapshot. It's a snapshot of a New York City person. You know, like, I know that guy. We've worked with a guy like that. You know what I mean? Like, we know this guy that's like, I don't know, the big fucking gun. Am I going to be on TV? Huh? Am I going to be on TV? You know, it's just like, I think a lot of those lines and a lot of the interrogation scenes and all that are improv'd. To get that kind of feeling, and that these are just these people, you know, in a lot of ways, like the freaking sanitation worker with the Albanian wife, that guy kills me. You know, he just fucking kills me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think they do a good job of coloring our hostages in this movie, which is a, you know, happen like, you know, Speed does it really well, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And we see it done well in other movies too. But then in other movies, like even Dog Day Afternoon, like we have some hostage recognition and empathy with some of those characters. The one of the women that's a teller, the bank manager, things like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I tend to agree. And I think it's particularly relevant in this movie, because of the way the heist is set up, this kind of dropping some of the burglars, the bank robbers, in and out of the hostage situation so that they have alibis.
Yeah. Right.
Which is really confusing at first, because you're not quite really sure, even as an audience member, who is who. Like when Steve-O is getting dragged through the fucking offices by his fucking boots. Yeah. You're like, is this guy real? Is he? Wait, I thought, wasn't he the guy that was helping in the dig the hole in the store? Maybe not. Maybe it's just another generic white guy.
Right. Yeah. Right. Are they like getting the hostages to dig holes for them now too?
Right. Yeah. Like are they forced the hostages labor? Do the work? Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Totally. Totally. And then, like, as you continue watching it, like when Denzel comes in to meet Clive Owen face to face, and Clive gives him like the tour, you can very much tell that all of the other people in masks with guns are clearly bound and have their guns are just taped to their hands, so that like all of the real. So that even Denzel couldn't, in the post interviews or whatever, in the debriefing, couldn't be like, well, one guy was 6'3 and 250, and there was a smaller person that was like 5'2, or, you know, like, because they're all different. So, like, that's another cool, again, like Clive at the beginning being like, pay very close attention, you know?
Yeah.
Just the fun part of it, you know? It's just a fun. And then, so then right after this old guy gets brought out, we get our first cut to a flash forward that kind of comes out of the blue in this first time. We're like, whoa. Yeah, okay, we're doing post interviews now. Oh, okay.
Right. We start our witness testimonies.
Yeah, yeah. And so then you get to start figuring things out, like from details given after the fact in real time and from the voiceovers or whatever that Clive Owen's giving from beforehand too. So it's just this kind of fun way to go on the journey to figure out like what's happening and what's the point. And
Right. It's a good way to reveal details to the audience so that they feel like they're piecing things together,
mm-hmm.
because they don't have a weeks long investigation to piece things together. Right. We have 2 hours. Right. So it gives us as audience that gratification of like, oh, I wonder, wait, wasn't that the girl that was unpicking the lock on the bot?
Mm-hmm.
It was those eyes. Yeah, it was her. Oh, they got out. Wait, did all of them get it? Like, you know,
yeah, so
you're doing that. You're doing that whole thing. And that's like, that's the fun of the heist movie, right?
Yeah, right.
You know, I love puzzle box stuff. I often malign puzzle box stuff because I think it's a contemporary trend, especially in the past 15 years, of being a substitute for any sort of substance in a story.
Yeah.
It's just like, look at this really complex puzzle. Can you figure it out by the time we get to the end?
Right.
But I don't think that's this movie. I think this movie plays along really nicely and gives the audience enough clues and keeps them informed to keep moving along with the story at a pace where they also don't get too far ahead of it. Either,
yeah.
Right.
Right. Yes.
And that there's not some fucking random MacGuffin at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's just like, oh, and they had a secret submarine hidden in the sewers of New York.
Yeah.
That we only showed you in the last minute. Like, there's no deus ex machina, right? Like,
yes.
How do you feel about the kind of green tinge and saturation that we get in these witness scenes?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't necessarily know. I kind of feel like it's, I think it's a little heavy. I like that there's a change in it. I think there should be a different type of cue to or tinge or whatever to show a different timeline. But I feel like it's a little late on, you know, paint an inch thick.
Yeah, I agree. I like the differentiation. I think it's important. I think the kind of like overexposure is really nice too when they're, especially when we're looking at the Polaroids of the hostage photographs and we can't like really make out details. That's kind of a great way to align ourselves with the hostage's perspective. But at the same time, I also think particularly that green tinge is very mid 2000s. Like
yeah,
that feels
for sure.
Like,
yeah.
like if I saw that and I had to guess an era, I'd be like, like 2006 to 2009, maybe 2004 to 2009, somewhere in there. I feel like that's something that's like a very mid 2000s look.
Sure. We get that some in the Bourne movies too, that kind of look.
Same thing. Harry Potter does the same.
Yeah. Yep.
And maybe it's just that decade is maybe a more generous way to interpret it. But yeah, it's a look that I like. It doesn't bug me, but I do feel it's a little thick.
Yeah. Two C's.
Yeah.
Cool.
I was just going to jump ahead. I mean,
yeah, do it. That's why I was like, I don't know.
I love when Chris Plummer comes to the mobile command station.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's way far ahead. Go for it. Do it.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, we have this scene with Vikram, the Sikh, in between here.
That's the only one I wanted to really call out was just,
it's interesting, right? Like so Spike Lee didn't write this movie. And you can tell, because the way that this movie, but you can also feel Spike Lee's influence on this. And maybe I'm speaking from a position of complete, from an obtuse perspective. But it feels like the way that this movie tries to engage with racism and sexism and prejudice and the treatment of police treatment in the city is a little clumsy. I think the intent is there clearly, and I think the points that they're making are really good, but it does kind of feel grafted on to this story a little bit. It feels like when you're watching a series and the B plot is just kind of there to, this is a terrible example, but to fill time or feel a terrible thing to say, but like fill time. And I don't think it's here to fill time, but it does feel secondary. It feels like Spike Lee got hired to do this big budget action movie, or moderately budgeted action movie, big budget at the time. this is still pre-Marvel. And it feels like he was like, great, but I want to bring my own sensibility as a filmmaker to it. I want to bring things that are important to me to it. And he does, but it feels a little pasted together.
Yeah.
Do you have that same sense?
Yeah, no, I feel like, because I as well don't have a huge breadth of knowledge with Spike Lee's stuff. You know, I've seen a lot more of his recent stuff than I have his earlier stuff. As far as like Black Klansman and The Five Bloods, specifically.
Did you see Chirac?
Nope, didn't see Chirac. And you can really see, you know, and so Black Klansman and The Five Bloods are in the past, you know, few years. So that's 10 to 15 years removed from when he makes Inside Man. So, yeah. You know, I feel like where you can see that this is a Spike Lee joint is these moments. And he doesn't do this movie without saying, we're putting this in here. I don't care.
We're going to talk about police treatment. We're going to talk. Yeah.
And how interesting is it to gingerly in some ways and very much in your face in other ways, in an immediate post 9/11 New York City, to discuss the treatment of Arabs and Sheikhs and Muslims and people of Islamic descent and people who are not white. But specifically, like, he does spend a lot of time on, give me my fucking turban. I'm not talking to you to give my turban. It's again,
yeah,
like,
I'm a Sikh. It's part of my religion. Like,
yeah, right. He called me an Arab. I'm not an Arab. And then, you know, you get the police captain that's like, yeah, I don't think you heard that right, but we're going to get you your turban, but you didn't, I think you were distressed, you know, Willem Dafoe says and all that. And I think that's just, you know, a really ballsy move in 2006 when we're, you know, in the height of the second Bush administration.
Yeah,
we're in the height of the war in Iraq.
This is prime Patriot Act. This is.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so I think that in your face element of it, I appreciated, even though it wasn't part of the story, because then it made this story more worth telling. It gave something else to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even though it is clumsy, I agree. And I don't think it would be as clumsy if Spike Lee wrote this
movie. I don't think so either. I think it would be much more intertwined.
Yes.
But all of the points that he's making are so prescient as well. Like, not prescient. It's just that we're hearing them now, and maybe weren't hearing them 15 years ago when people are protesting police brutality, and we're like, that doesn't happen.
Right, right.
That's not a thing.
And how interesting watching this in the context of now accepting or hoping to accept refugees from Afghanistan after now we're, you know, on the other side of it. And now what is the treatment and how does that change and what has changed in the past 15 years and what had, you know, all that. Yeah, I agree. I agree.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to make sure I called that out.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And there are multiple moments too. I mean, the conversation with that Frasier has with the police officer, there are, you know, and I mean, even in this conversation, Frasier makes a joke about, well, you can get a cab.
Right.
You know, so the racist underpinnings of this show, of this movie, with, you know, with a black lead, with a black supporting actor as well. And the kind of, you know, they immediately walk into this mobile command unit and Dafoe looks at them and is like, I'm not, no.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Not right. Talking to you.
That's so true.
So you can, yeah. So there is this underlying sensibility, that I think is well-intentioned, but yeah, for me, it just feels a little, worst. Yes. To me, I actually think what probably happens here is it feels like producer influence of like, you can keep some of this, but we got to get back to the action. Mm-hmm. It always feels like these scenes are okay. Yeah, this is important, but we got to get back to the action.
Yeah. Like maybe Spike Lee's, you know, director's cut of this is 2 hours and 45 minutes. And there were 30 minutes extra of exploring more of this or something.
Yeah. Maybe
that the producers go, hey, We'll give you a couple, but we got to keep going back, you know.
We want to make some money.
Yeah, right.
Nobody wants to listen to that you preach, right?
Yeah.
When in fact people are like, "No, I would really like that. Please."
Yeah. Right.
I'd like to hear all of that.
Yeah.
And then we can still do the heist stuff, but no, give me some of that.
Yeah.
But, you know, not to be an exact example of what I just said, but Chris Plummer walking into this mobile command station is one of the funniest moments in the whole fucking movie, man. He walks in, he's on his cane. He's like, "I'm just here to help. Have they made any demands?" And Frasier goes, "Well, they want a jet." And like, it's the perfect amount of comedic space and timing before Case goes, "Would you like me to arrange it for you?"
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
I fucking lost it, man. It is like, it's so well timed and so well executed.
Yeah.
And like the look that Chris Plummer gives to Denzel Washington and the look that Denzel then gives to Chris Plummer, it's like they are right on the verge of breaking, is what it feels like.
Yeah.
Of just like, "Would you like me to arrange it for you?"
Yeah, that's a great scene. It's a great scene. And then it's right here too, where he is this where he calls he says, "You're a magnificent cunt," to Jodie Foster. It's right around here, because it's before that, but I think it's right around this time.
That's the mayor that says that, right?
Oh, you're right. Yeah, it's the mayor, because Jodie Foster goes, "You're going to get me in there." That's right. Yeah, thank you for correcting me. That, I love that moment, because like I mentioned earlier, Jodie Foster, I think, does great work in that moment to just receive it, because it's abrasive to hear. Like, I wasn't expecting that line to come out, and you're like, "Oh, fuck. How is she going to, what, you know?" And she just looks and goes, "Thank you." And then leaves. And I'm like, that's a good Jodie Foster moment for me. Really like.
Yeah. And I mean, it's true to what she says later in the movie too, of like, "I'm not in the business of, you know, I'm in the business of making friends, not enemies."
Yeah. Right.
So that kind of like grin and bear it attitude.
Mm-hmm.
I think she does a really nice job of giving us that sense that she's suppressing what she really wants to say. That moment also works for me, but I feel like she relies on that "I'm suppressing what I really want to say" attitude a little too much in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be direction, could be the script, could be her, but
yeah, sure.
Or it's more likely a combination of all of that.
Yeah, editing too, and what story they want to choose to tell. I think that moment is what Jodie Foster does really well, because that's what she does really well in Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, next thing I have is one of the interview scenes, because I know you're going to love this and might have written it down as well. One of the interview scenes with the character of Wing, who's Ken Leung. And this is the guy who we met because he was distracted by the woman talking on the phone earlier.
Yeah.
And he says, "Oh, yeah, yeah, I recognize her. She was online before me." Yeah, yeah. And he was on the line, and he was on, and that guy was online too. it's the worst. But I know, and we've talked about this on this podcast before, but that was another one of those New York moment things where I'm like, yeah, that's true writing, and that's what they would say, and that's what they do say. You're not in line, you're online. Next on the line.
As if there is a line that is drawn on the ground.
Yeah, you're online that you're standing, and I've adopted a lot of East Coast-isms, and that is one that I will never be able to adopt ever.
No.
Because you can't say it. Like,
doesn't make any
sense. The first time
someone
said that to me, it was like, "Hey, are you online?" And I like pulled out my phone and was like, "Yeah, I have service." And they're like, "No, are you fucking waiting for your food?" And I was like, Yeah, I'm in line. And I go, yeah, that's why I asked. Are you fucking online? Like, I got into a fight. I was like, I'm sorry. I thought you asked if you needed, like, service. Because he said, are you online? And I never heard it before.
Ugh. Yeah, that's so that's just, a like, hard, rung out. That's a hard one to swallow, man. I can't take it.
And so he says, yeah, I was, you know, I was online with this woman, right? She was right here. And you're like, well, how do you know it's her? And he says, she has certain qualities or whatever. And he's like, she has a nice rack, essentially. And then this next little lotsy that we get with the two detectives, Bill and Keith, where I think it's shot really well. It's and makes me laugh that you just see Chiwetel just kind of like, slowly his eyes just kind of like go down or the want to look down. Like you can see it's a close up on that character on Detective Bill. And you can see that he's looking peripherally, even though his eyes are looking straight.
Right.
You know,
yeah, it's soft focus. He's not trying to stare.
Yeah. Yeah. And then just like seeing when he chooses to pick his moments to just kind of glance down at the low cut shirt or whatever, at the cleavage is just, it's another great moment of comedic timing and pacing. And I think really great work by all of everyone involved. It's hilarious to me.
It is. It works. The laugh plays for sure.
Yes. Similar, then, you know, and again, sorry if I'm jumping too fast, but then this Albanian construction worker fucking kills me. Like, I just love that guy. I know he's a little over the top, but everything he fucking says, I'm just in. I love his whole character. Like, I don't fucking know. I didn't say I speak Albanian. I said it is Albanian. I'm a fucking, wow, man, I never should have fucking come in here. You know, just that blue collar Queens
guy.
Just
my luck, yeah.
Yeah. I think he, I don't know if that actor has done anything else. I didn't look it up afterward. I should have. I don't know if like he is just that guy that walks in the room like, oh, great. We don't, you know, we're just going to cast him. Or if he is putting on that character, I don't know to what level he's just being himself is what I'm trying to say. But either way, it fucking works. And I dig it.
Yeah. I have no complaints.
Good.
No complaints.
That guy fucking makes me laugh.
Yeah, the next scene that struck me was the scene of the kid playing his PSP in the vault. And that kind of glamorization and fetishization of being a bank robber, of killing people, of being violent. And the relative response that I think it's Dalton that walks in there with him, that he gives of like, I need to talk to you, like finish your slice. And we're going to go talk to your dad
about this video game,
about this game. And you know, obviously clearly Dalton has a lot of principles. He makes very clear that he has a lot of principles, both on violence and love and the treatment of Jews, or Jewish people rather, but yeah, I don't know. I think the kid's really good. It's hard to get good kid actors, I think, to resonate and not feel like they've just been told to say something and then they say that thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, I just the scene, it was also just like a nice caesura from the rest of the kind of tension and action. It was like there was no foreboding sense that anything was going to go wrong or that he was going to hurt the kid or anything like that. Like, it was just this nice breath that happened. It's also funny that he's just sitting on a saran wrap stack of cash.
Yeah, right. Right.
So,
and it's an interesting slice of life too. You know, I feel like this is where Spike Lee really hits a home run with his storytelling and everything is these types of scenes. You see it a lot in the movies that work well, you know, where you have a just kind of intimate scene that you're just kind of not expecting. And you're like, yeah, this is, it felt personal. You know, it felt like Spike Lee was really like, no, it felt like Spike Lee wrote that scene to me.
Yeah.
You know,
very, you know, very possible for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, the next shot I wanted to just call out is Clive Owen take let me make sure I know where. Yeah, the pizza's already been given, and Clive Owen, and Clive Owen finally takes his mask off, and he's standing in the vault, mm-hmm. and he has his mask off, and he's just the framing of it, the lighting, he's center on the in the frame, and the camera pulls back, and it goes through like two sets of bars, and he just sort of like leans in a way that's just sort of like classic Bond villain kind of shot, like you would see in any of the Bond movies, and it's just really, you know, the music is going, and in general, I'm not a huge. I think the scoring, the composing is a little all over the place in this movie. I think there are some parts that hit really well and others that don't make any sense.
I agree.
But here in this scene, the music, the lighting, the framing, all just kind of click, kind of zoop into place. And I was like, that's a fucking cool moment. The mastermind behind the thing, just having a moment, taking a breath before we get into the next act of his bank robbery.
Yeah. Next, you won't be sucking a pina colada.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Yep. And I just, it's so good having Denzel and Clive paired together.
Yeah, I too have a good time in these scenes. And I think this negotiation particularly is really great. Phone acting is hard.
Yes, it is.
It's really fucking hard.
Yep.
Doesn't seem like it should be, but it's really fucking hard. And I think they both do a really nice job. This is another moment to this particular negotiation where Denzel does, it's probably a little bit of an actor trick where he's laughing, but he's actually saying some really serious shit through it. Mm-hmm. Where he's like, oh, this is funny. Yeah, I'm going to fuck you up. Yeah, like that type of, mm-hmm. you know, sentiment. And that's what he does on that pina colada line as well. Yeah. And I think it works really well. Mm-hmm.
And Clive on the other side of this, you know, when we end this conversation, Denzel just goes, all right, just stay calm. All right, let's just keep it. Stay calm. And Clive Owen just in the perfect British, cool. Don't I sound calm to you?
Don't I sound calm?
Yeah. And you're like,
you're like, actually, yes, yeah. you sound really fucking calm.
Yeah, and now I'm not calm anymore because, oh, Jesus, you are too calm. What is happening? It's such a good, and like you said, because they're not, I was actually curious about this. Do you think for this type of scene that they would have the other actor present or to react the lines off of? Because most phone scenes, you have a PA read the opposite line or whatever.
Right. Yeah. No, I think for this one, probably.
I would think so, right?
Unless their shooting schedules were just so, you know, unless it was one of those things where, like, you know, because of the way production schedules work, they were shooting all of the mobile police unit scenes
right
over the course of 3 days, and Clive Owen was able to not be there. Mm-hmm. But I would be surprised for a scene, because a lot of this movie rides on this scene, because this is the establishment of their relationship.
Right.
This is the cat and mouse, you know, coming together scene. So I'd be surprised if he wasn't there, but I can absolutely see a reality where it's just like, yeah, you know, the second unit is going to go with this police command unit and shoot all of the interior police command unit scenes while we shoot all of the bank, you know, the vault scenes with Clive on the same day, but on a separate set, you know?
Sure. Sure. Yeah. 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 Yep. And then they have the Grand Central Station combo.
Yeah. New Yorkers arguing about transportation. No, no, no. Don't take the fucking
mm-hmm.
You don't want to, you no, don't take the 6 train, then it's, you're gonna get stopped. No,
now let me tell you what you got to do is you transfer at the Times Square, and then you from there you go and take the dance over here. That's the way you gotta do it, and
then you're gonna get on the bus, and I know nobody likes to get on the bus, but there's actually a bus lane and it's much faster. You're gonna get across town, otherwise you're waiting for the L forever. It's always under construction, it's flooded half the fucking time.
Yeah, God, I think that was like my favorite moment in this whole movie, only because I we've had that shared experience of living in New York and talking about transportation.
Yeah, and it's not like New Yorkers in the way that we're like using the dialect too. That's just for effect, right? Like anybody that lives in this city, always like there are always conversations about transportation. Like, oh, I'm meeting my friend at this bar in the Village. What's the best way? You know, what? How should I get there?
Right.
And then, you know.
Yeah. Should I take, you know, or I'm living in Queens and I got to get to Brooklyn. Should I take the N all the way through Manhattan to get into Brooklyn? Or should I do transfer to 7 to the G and then maybe go to the E or then maybe
should I actually get on a bus? Because even though it feels like it's slower, it's not.
Yeah. Right. Or just fuck it and get a cab. Yeah. You know? Yeah. And then the next big shot that I fucking loved, especially, you know, thinking about Spike Lee and the types of movies he likes to make and stories he likes to tell is when Denzel and Jodie Foster are speaking in front of the Never Forget 9/11 thing. I think that is a beautiful shot that is so like New York, you know, and the shadowing, the lighting, you know, and also with like, there's a lot of focus on law enforcement and cops in this movie and how much that, you know, that was a focus of 9/11 and, you know, FDNY and all that kind of stuff, while also in the same breath talking about, quote unquote, oh fuck, he's an Arab, you know? So like just right. Seeing both of those juxtaposed together made this movie just a little bit, I just appreciated it more than I was expecting.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of Spike's personality too, right? He loves this city more than anybody, and particularly Brooklyn, but yeah. Like he's so much a New Yorker, even though he was born in the South, but so much a New Yorker. And he clearly is constantly reconciling with living in this city that he loves and this culture that he loves, but also having to grapple with all of the terrible things about this city too. So
yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And never is it more apparent than in this interrogation, when Keith asked the kid, "You scared?" "Nah, I'm from Brooklyn."
You're like, oh shit. All right.
Yeah, like, oh, all right, Bed-Stuy.
Yeah. Where you got next? Where you at?
I actually really like what Willem Dafoe's doing in this movie. I think there's some really interesting subtle shifts. And I also like, I love just watching Willem Dafoe think.
Yeah.
Like anytime he's presented with anything he has to think about, whether it's the fucking $5 line from earlier or now when we're, you know, considering this, you know, hostage situation and bank heist and things like that. Just, he has such great lines in his face and such expressive eyes. And he's so active too. I mean, it all comes through because he's a great actor.
Yes.
That I love, like, anytime Willem Dafoe is thinking on stage or thinking on screen, especially when it's like in the quizzical, why the fuck would you ever think that or do that, or you know, his that kind of judgment.
Are you
that
a
comes
fucking
through.
Idiot? Like,
yeah,
what?
Like, what? Why are you wasting my time?
I always feel safe when he's on screen. I'm like, okay, good. I don't have to worry. You know, I'm gonna enjoy this. You know. I don't have to worry about, yeah. Oh, is his accent going to be good? Or is he going to be present? Is he going to, like, no, I know I'm going to be safe when he's on screen.
Yeah.
Next thing I have is when Jody and, I should use their character names, Madeline?
Yeah.
Madeline and Dalton are meeting in the bank where, when she can go in, you know, Clive Owen invites her in and not Denzel, which I think is a cool kind of plot story thing of just like pissing contest type thing. And not much to say about this scene, but I just really love the lighting, and especially on Clive's face, because he has his mask up and he's sort of in between the like teller bars.
Yeah.
And there's just this really, really cool shadow and whatnot that I really dig in that whole scene. I thought it's lit very well.
Yeah, I entirely agree. That scene is really effective for me in terms of setting the stage and that kind of, you know, the kind of, it's not a motif, but I guess it's a symbol or a theme, probably a symbol of, you know, he invites her into the bank. They don't have to have this conversation through the teller bars.
Right.
But instead they do. And it kind of indicates this very transactional experience.
Oh, sure.
Of somebody needs something, somebody wants something, and they have this interchange of information, right? There's mm-hmm. there's no personal aspect. There's no touching. There's no violence. There's nothing like that. It is purely transactional in nature. Mm-hmm. And so setting it through those teller bars, through that bank counter, I think, you know, leads to that kind of feeling of that experience.
It's 100% true. I didn't even think about it on that level. Checks out. But it is exactly right. Like, there's the sort of wordplay and almost flirtatiousness that we get between Detective Keith and Dalton. We don't get that in this scene. You know, we don't get that sort of like, you're going to be sucking on something worse than Mai Tais. Or it's just like, no. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Sucking on something worse than Mai Tais?
Is that what you said it was?
The joke is the fact that it's a pina colada.
Oh, pina colada. Whatever it was. To be frank and honest, I don't have a whole lot more notes because we kind of like
same
figure things out. Interesting.
We've also talked about a lot of it. So
true.
I do want to bring up when Keith gets fired, when Fraser gets fired, but is reprimanded by the captain.
Yes.
I just want to call, I fucking love, his name is Peter Garrity. He is like an all-time character actor.
Uh-huh.
He's also, if you like him in this, he's also in a television show on Amazon, also heist based, con man based, called Sneaky Pete, with Giovanni Ribisi. So every time I see Peter Garrity show up, I love everything that he brings.
Yes. I just wanted to also call out too, before we get too far away, that, you know, so that, you know, Denzel goes in and tackles him and all that kind of stuff. And then they show them shooting a hostage in the window, which we think is real. Mm-hmm. And there's a shot of like Denzel rolling to the front door,
yep,
which is like the only kind of that shot in the whole movie. And I feel like that is Spike Lee right there, that we see a lot of that, those type of shots in his more recent stuff that I'm more familiar with. But it came out of nowhere and it didn't fit with anything. And in the moment I was like, oh, this is kind of weird. And then I think afterward I was cool with it and okay with it, because the hostage gets shot out of nowhere, according to Denzel's character, you know? So his world does get thrown into a tizzy.
Yeah. I think it grows on me too. It certainly is jarring, mm-hmm, at the very least. Mm-hmm. I think the intent is right. This kind of myopic focus that Denzel all of a sudden has, you know, bull seeing red or whatever.
Yeah.
Right. And completely everything else is blocked out and blurred out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know necessarily that it's successful.
Yeah.
But I don't hate it either.
Yeah. I'm exactly that same. Yeah. I feel like if Spike Lee has more autonomy over this whole project, we get maybe it might fit more in the world, even if that still is the first shot in that movie of that type. It might still fit more.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. And, I mean, maybe he had full autonomy.
Yeah, true.
That's
true.
And just made that decision because he thought it looked cool and fit the scene. And sometimes we make strong choices and they don't work.
Yeah, right. But
strong, but wrong.
At least he's making a strong choice and not just exactly making another boring heist movie.
Right. Like, how many times can we see Denzel walk or run up to that door? Right.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
I do love, again, not to stop me if I'm skipping too far ahead, but I love the It's another great heist movie trope. We see it in the Soderbergh heist movies a lot, where the gang or the crew or whatever, or the cops are talking about what is going to happen. Okay. And we see it happen as they're talking about what is going to happen.
Yes.
And so once Willem Dafoe gains his character, Darius, I think is his name, gains control over the scene, is like, we're going in. And he talks his crew through how they're going to go in and the different tactical challenges they're going to face and things like that. And they show us what it might look like.
Yes.
In terms of the gunfire and the killing, you know, shooting hostages, things like that. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, there was a firefight.
I know. I kept thinking of that line too. Yeah, and I think it's done pretty effectively here too, because for a half second you're like, "Oh shit! Are they actually doing it? Are we hearing a voiceover of the real raid?
Are we getting that trope where, like in Ocean's 11, where they walk us through the heist as it's actually happening?
Right. Or are we getting the South Park version where they're like, "No, hold up, stop! You know." I think that's done really well. The next thing I have is the whole, like, the first of our figuring it all out montage where the hostages are all released. I love Clive Owen's like, ah, shit. Like, they're sending it in and you're like, fuck. All right, well, time to go, you know. Yeah, and they send all the...
I guess what we have now is going to have to be good enough.
Yeah, because I'm not fucking killing people and I'm not going to get into a firefight.
I hope the hole you dug me is deep enough to hide my shit for a week.
Yeah, right? Seriously. And so then, yeah, literally. So they, you know, the hostages all get like sent out and there's a mass chaos and you get people like the cops don't really know what to do. And Denzel goes in there and then we get our like figuring it all out, like, oh. Yeah. Who is it? Oh, there. No one's here. Clear. Oh.
Captain, come to here. Yes. Come to here.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. And then they, you know, they realize that they got played, you know, but that whole, without going into specifics of every shot and every moment, that whole montage was just fun.
Oh yeah. It's great.
Heist trope. And I was in and I loved it. And I was just like, oh man, they got you.
And even though the characters in this movie have said numerous times, like, oh, I don't think he's violent. Like, he's not violent. He's not a violent guy. There's still, Spike Lee does such a great job of keeping that tension in the air of like when we see the trash bags in the one storage room or we see the bag in the other room, of being like, did they actually leave something explosives? Mm-hmm. Like, is there actually Semtex around? Like,
yeah, right.
There's still enough of that tension to keep this scene moving and feel exciting. So,
right. Yeah. 100% agree. There's a, throughout this, they to again, sort of bookend our first entrance into the bank and our last entrance into the bank. There's a lot of like long takes, one shots to like follow people in. And again, talking in our earlier conversation about building the tension of like, oh, is someone there? Is someone going to be strapped to there with a suicide switch? Are they going to like, what's going to happen? What's around the corner? All that stuff until we get clear all the way around. But I think there's good camera work in that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think the camera work in this movie is really, really good.
Yeah. There's a lot of circling, you know, yeah, like
it's always
with the mayor and Jodie Foster, that scene and like, or Clive and Denzel. It's always like, we're just going around in circles or just, yeah.
And I think a lot of that does add to that feeling of this is immediate. This is happening in real time. This is, we're not cutting and editing around things to try to crunch a lot of things into a short amount of time. I also think though, it is particularly representative of the period.
Yes.
I feel like this is also a pretty in vogue camera style at this point. Children of Men does a lot of similar things.
Yes.
This movie definitely feels mid-2000s to me, and not just because of the costumes or tech.
Big time.
I feel like this movie takes a little bit too long to wrap up.
I answer so.
I think it's all interesting, but it feels a little sluggish in the last 20 minutes. The different revelations and things like that. I mean, the revelation of him being in the wall is great. You know, love that. Mm-hmm. There's only one other scene that I want to talk about, and it's the scene that I've been most anxious to talk about the entire time.
Okay. Then let me just get a couple things out so we can have that. So I just wanted to ask, because, you know, a lot of these kind of happy accidents happen in film and whatnot, and a lot of it is very specifically planned, right? So Denzel is debriefing the captain about everything. He's like, well, you know, they all came out, so they're, you know, we can't fingerprint them because they have everyone here. We got this here. You're like, we're kind of stuck, and the captain tells him to bury it. That scene.
Yeah.
In the middle of Denzel telling them, he just goes, excuse me, and keeps going. Do you think that was planned, or did Denzel, the actor, have something in his throat and then kept going? And then Spike Lee was like, I don't know, that was fucking
I think
cool.
It's probably the latter. I think it's probably the latter.
Yeah. That
he just got something caught in his throat, or was dry, or had a slight cold, or whatever, and just had to cough, and keeps rolling.
Yeah,
because they didn't say cut, so you keep going, right?
I'm hoping it's that, because I think that's just fucking pro, man.
It's always a great. It's great.
All right, let's get to the scene that you want to talk about. What are you going to talk about?
So
I'm excited.
What I particularly want to talk about, and it's the scene, it is the one thing that like absolutely really bugged me so much so that I went back and watched it like 7 times.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Not hyperbole.
Yep.
Like I kind of like the idea of the way this plot resolves in terms of, you know, Clive Owen steals the diamonds, but leaves the ring so that we can still expose Arthur Case as a war profiteer. And not, you know, Nazi sympathizer. It feels more like a sequel probably that needs to happen in terms, I know there's technically a sequel to this movie, but we're just going to ignore that for the purpose of this conversation.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like there could be a whole detective story about uncovering the truth of this ring and how it came and like the cat and mouse game. Like, I think that'd actually kind of be pretty interesting. But, you know, he walks into Arthur Case's office, shows him the ring and gives him the fucking finger, right? He says something about like, when I find, you know, what about this ring, or love, you know, lovely rings, makes a point of showing the ring to Arthur Case so that he knows that it exists. When he shows that ring, it is a digital hand and a digital fucking finger and ring.
No.
And it comes up like a fucking PowerPoint transition.
Oh.
It goes, zoop, and then it stutters on its way down.
Oh.
And it is egregious.
That is horrible.
It is egregious. If you didn't notice it, I think we should pause the podcast and you should go watch it. Oh my God. It is so bad.
Wow. That's crazy. I'm surprised it didn't. The notes I have on this scene were more about how Denzel crafts this sort of interrogation of Mr. Case.
It's great.
That's what I was wrapped up in. And maybe I was like writing notes about that while it happened, because I didn't see that. And
it happens really quickly. Like
I remember the ring having like coming up, but
it's, oh my God.
All right. Last couple of notes here for me, you know, the Denzel goes back to his wife for Big Willie and the twins time, and which is just awesome. You know, did you bring Big Willie and the twins? But I just think, you know, outside of that silliness, when Denzel shows up in the room, like at the doorway, there's like this really cool detective PI silhouette type shot, and we get the trumpet and the jazzy trombone in there, and and it's just really like film noir and old, like PI on the case coming home finally after a long day.
Right, it might as well be Gregory Peck or
absolutely man, or any number of the like
old Hollywood
detective things. And then when Denzel figures it all out at the end, where he's like, oh wait a minute,
he finds the diamond in his pocket, right?
Yeah, right. And he's like, oh, and just like, oh, you know, that like series of I think it's great work, and it's just also kind of fun for us because we as audience know that you bumped into him, man. You bumped into him right there in the bank. Oh, shit.
How did you not notice?
Yeah.
He's a 6'4" guy, British guy, and he smells like shit. How did you not notice?
Because you're in New York. I wouldn't have fucking noticed, man.
Yeah,
it's like fair. The podcast we did with John O'Connor, the podcast I did with John O'Connor where we did Ninja Turtles, and on one of them, one of the Ninja Turtles just like sitting on the subway, and I'm like, yeah, I wouldn't notice it. If I'm in New York on the way to work and there is legitimately a Ninja Turtle with a hat and a giant trench coat on sitting at the other end of the subway, I would not clock it. I wouldn't have clocked it. There's no way. I would have been like, okay, whatever. It's a fucking whatever.
Maybe if I was sitting directly next to him or across from him. Maybe, yeah.
Right. But, maybe. But it's not like, you know, so even that in this movie, I'm like, okay, fine. Yeah, I get that. But what's fun about it is that we as audience have one last secret that we know that our lead character doesn't, you know.
Right.
Which is just fun, you know. And then, you know, we get that the Bollywood over the faces in the close-ups, you know, at the end is baller. I dig it. You know, I kind of dig that sort of thing in this movie. I don't always like it,
yeah,
but in this movie, I dug it. It was like, here are the players, here are the cast or whatever. And it worked for me. I like
that. Yeah, I mean, it's very Steven Soderbergh.
Yes.
That's the only other thing that I wanted to talk about, too, is I do love the idea that we have a heist movie called Inside Man, and that there's not actually an inside man that helps with the heist at all, but rather the movie refers to Clive Owen just being inside of a wall.
Yeah. yeah. Yep.
I think it's pretty cheeky.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a cool reveal, too, when you're like, oh, shit. You know, when we find out that Clive's been living behind that wall and they like rebuilt it, like that's a fun scene and a fun reveal. Yeah. I remember the first time I saw it, I was like, no way. Did you see it coming? Did you see that?
I didn't. I figured he was still inside the bank in some capacity. Mm-hmm. I assumed it had something to do with the hole they were digging and things like that. I didn't anticipate them building an entirely fake wall.
Yeah.
Right. But I knew he was still there. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Sure. Yeah. That's cool, man. Well, I'm glad you like this movie. I enjoy this movie. This is a fun palate cleanser. And so then does Spike Lee get your Judi Dench?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, it's him or Denzel, right? Like, in my opinion. I think for me, yeah, I think it is Spike Lee. I think the stitching of this movie is really good. The camera direction is really good. I think he gets a lot out of a pretty mediocre script for the most part.
Yeah.
And manages to keep the suspension or the tension suspended for a really long time, mm-hmm. which is impressive.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause even in some of the like Soderbergh heist movies, you're like, all right, they're going to get out of this. I know how this ends.
Right.
There's going to be some cheeky way or whatever, or, you know, and they're a little bit of a different genre too. This is much more of a drama thriller, and the Ocean's movies, Logan Lucky, things like that are a little bit more in the
action comedy
comic world. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's a hard one for me. I think if I were to just think about is this randomly, like think about Inside Man, I think about Denzel and Clive Owen, and I would probably give it to one of those. But to this unique experience of me watching it this time, I'm going to actually give this to the ensemble of the acting ensemble to
Cop
include.
Out.
No, not the cops. Just. no, because I so in thank you. I get one a season, and that probably was my one. Just blow my wad early, you know.
You use it up early, yeah.
Yep. yeah, I think this time through, I think because I was pretty familiar with this movie, mm-hmm. that the life of New York really spoke to me, and maybe that's because I'm missing New York, haven't moved out of it for, you know, almost a year. I don't know how long it's been. that I really found such pleasure and joy from the authentic, you know, representation of just the people of New York, the people who you'd meet, you know, like you think about in New York where you're like on a subway randomly to go to work or whatever. And if that subway were to break down, now you're with a random ass assortment of people. And who are these people? You know, sure. I think there's something cool about that. And I think they did a good enough job that made me laugh and made me kind of look at this with new eyes. So I'm going to give it to them. I know a lot of it was improv, which is fucking hard to do, especially in these interrogation scenes. Just awesome. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to go with when I watch Inside Man as like a, you know, a fun popcorn movie for me. You know, I think it's like when you have someone that's like, I want to watch Ocean's 11, but I've seen those movies so many times. Like, all right, well, Dog Day Afternoon's a horrible movie yet, so let's do...
definitely not, you know, quintessential American cinema or anything like that.
So. No. Yeah, of course not. Yeah. If you want quintessential American cinema, you got to go Marvel.
No lasting impressions. No. Nope.
No, of course not.
No legacy.
You'll get more enjoyment out of Inside Man referencing Dog Day Afternoon than watching. No, I kid. I have an appreciation for Dog Day Afternoon, and that
you don't have to lie.
Look, no, I do have an appreciation. When do you watch this movie? When do you watch Inside Man? Now that you've seen it once.
Yeah, now that I've seen it once. No, this occupies a very similar territory for me as like The Town. That same kind of, I want an action movie. I want something that's exciting and moves, that's not too serious. But I'm also looking for something that's a little more exciting than, say, an Ocean's movie, right? That relies much more on its characters and its humor than it does its actual heist. So... that's where it lives for me, is kind of in the dramatic heist world.
That's good, man. So does this become one of your like relative rotation movies where you kind of think of it? Did you enjoy it enough to be like, yeah, you know what? I'll watch this again every couple years or whatever.
Yeah, I think so. I think cool. So. I think that probably slots in. I don't think it surpasses. The Town is really like my go-to in this particular subgenre.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it quite eclipses that, but yeah, no, this is definitely a movie that I will watch again.
Cool. That's good to know, man. That's good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And I'm glad I enjoyed it selfishly. So. Fuck you, Brett. I thought this was America.
Oh boy.
Just South Park references galore. So next week, no, well, next episode will be Michael Clayton. And, yeah,
which is actually a good companion movie to this. Jodie Foster's character in this movie is a quintessential fixer, as is Michael Clayton. So,
okay, cool.
George Clooney is excellent in it, as is Tilda Swinton.
I bet. I'm excited.
It's great.
So movie. That is next episode. Follow us Facebook and Instagram, Movies in the Buff, Twitter, Buff Movies, email, watchingmoviesinthebuff@gmail.com. And please rate, review, subscribe. Stay up on the know. We got some exciting things coming in December, which will be good. And tune in for next episode of Michael Clayton. All right, Brett, I'm going to go first.
Okay.
Last time I had my Johnson pulled this good, it cost me $5. $5? Yeah, Baby Town, don't ask.
That's a good one. That's nice. I like that. My name is Dalton Russell. Pay strict attention to what I say because I choose my words carefully and I never repeat myself. I've told you my name. That's the who. The where could be most readily described as a prison cell, but there's a vast difference between being stuck in a tiny cell and being in prison. The what is easy. Recently, I planned and set in motion events to execute the perfect bank robbery. That's also the when. As for the why, beyond the obvious financial motivation, it's exceedingly simple. Because I can. Which leaves us only with the how. And therein, as the bard would tell us, lies Baby Town. That's been my favorite one since Alien.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, that was good, dude.
I'm Clive Owen.
You know.